Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power, where we're going to have a fun time this afternoon. How would you feel if you had grown up around campfires where stories of fabulous tales, weird creatures, legends of the past were a very common part of your life? Well, the gentleman that I have as a guest today, Raymond Buckland, he put together a book called Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic, Traveler's Stories, Spells, and Healings. We're going to be talking about a man that's originally from London, England, who the gypsy world is a very, very comfortable space to experience. Welcome to the show, Raymond.
Well, thanks very much, Donna. Very nice to be here.
Well, I think any time that we can have a good look at a culture that is just known all over for all kinds of stuff. I know here in the Pacific Northwest, there was a particular area in Tacoma, Washington, that when we first moved up here, said, oh, beware of the gypsies. That's the section of town that they live in. And you go, oh, really? I mean, it just is amazing how this lore has been perpetuated over the years. But your family is of the gypsy line. Give us a little bit of history about the gypsy and where it originated. How far back are they able to trace it?
Okay, it really goes back to about the 10th, 11th century. The gypsies originally came out of the north of India. At that time, there was a lot of trouble in the north of India. A lot of invasions by Kushites, by Greeks, by various people into that area, which really disrupted the local people to the point where eventually they started leaving. They decided, well, there's too much going on here. We've got to get out of here. It was pretty much the same sort of thing that was happening in Rwanda a few years back, with all the people having to move out of that area.
Mm-hmm.
But the people moved out of the north of India, and they moved across into neighboring countries, into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, on across into Persia, and so on. They moved in dribs and drabs, really, over a couple of hundred years or so, actually. They were traveling usually on foot or with a horse and cart if they were lucky. So it took some time, but they gradually traveled across heading towards Europe. Some of them went up north into Asia. Some of them went across the north of Africa and then from the end there across the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain and Portugal and into Europe that way. Others came into Europe the other way. And we have records of the travelers coming into these different countries at different times. Some of them eventually crossed the English Channel into England. And there are records of the Egyptians, as they were called, entering England, being in England in as early as 1513, I think was the earliest record. Now, when they started appearing in Europe, there were these strange people suddenly coming into the country, into the various countries, very dark, swarthy people in brightly colored costumes who had a certain mysterious air to them. And word went out that they were descendants of the ancient Egyptians. So people started referring to them as the Egyptians. Later on, this got shortened to Egyptians, and they were referred to as the Egyptians, and that eventually got shortened to Gypsies. So that's how they got their name. But the true name is Romani or Roma,
mm-hmm.
the old name. They have their own language, Romanus, which If you study it, you see that a lot of it is Sanskrit or Sanskrit in origin, which points to its origins in the north of India. They came into Europe, as I say, and they had no particular trade. They had to scrape a living. And this is really where we start getting the idea of gypsies being tramps and thieves, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
The gypsies traveled the roads, and their philosophy was that anything that grew, that came by way of nature, was a gift of the gods. So they might be traveling along a road, and they'd see this beautiful apple orchard, all these trees covered with apples, and they would think, well, this is wonderful, wonderful gift of the gods, and they would go in and they would help themselves to the apples, and they would fill baskets so that they could go on to the next village, the next town, and sell the apples and get some money on which to live. But of course, the farmer who developed these trees and who owned the trees was most irate and came storming out and saying, well, look, you're stealing my apples. But their feeling was, how can we steal something which comes from the gods? Nobody can own these things. So this is where it started, that they were classed as thieves. It was all innocence on their part. Now, later on, of course, as time went on and they had to survive as best they could, many times they did, in fact, resort to thievery and did certainly know what it was and what they were doing, but it was in order to survive. They tried to adapt themselves to their surroundings. If they would go into a country that was predominantly Roman Catholic, then they would declare themselves Roman Catholic. If they were in a country that was predominantly Protestant, then they would declare themselves Protestant. So they would try to fit in with everything that was going on. They had some wonderful ideas. There was a time when, well, in the 12th, 13th century, when it was felt that everybody should be very, very kind, should give alms, should treat foreigners, should treat poor people as best they could, should help them. And the gypsies knew this, so they decided to play on this. And they spread the word that they were on a mission, that they had been sent by the Pope, and that it was said that they had provided the nails that were used for crucifying Jesus. And so the Pope had given them a 7-year penance, and they had to work out this penance. So people took pity on them, and they provided food for them and gave them odd jobs to do. And everything seemed to be fine until suddenly people realized that, hey, wait a minute, more than 7 years have gone by, 14, 21, 30 years have gone by, and they're still living on charity. Charity was the big thing. I mean, the more charitable you were, the better chance you had of going into heaven, so it was mm-hmm. the thought. So the gypsies certainly played on that, and they were very good at playing on just about anything that seemed possible to keep them going. They were definitely moving along. They were without a particular home of their own, so they had to make do as best they could. And one of the ways they did it, of course, was by telling fortunes. You know, they were looked upon as guardians of the sacred mysteries, and they again played up on this. They were very, very good at not so much initially telling fortunes. I guess this is what it came down to. But of reading characters, and they were very psychically attuned. So they would read palms. The old gypsy word for a palm or a hand was duk, D-U-K. And so any sort of palm reading or any sort of fortune telling was referred to as dukkering or dukkering. It originally just referred to palm reading, but later on any form of fortune telling was referred to as dukkering. So these days, if you get a gypsy reading tarot cards, then he or she is duckering.
You know, Raymond, I just want to interrupt you for just a minute.
Sure.
Your information is wonderful, but I want my audience to know a little bit about you. Your grandfather was the first of the Buckland gypsies to give up traveling the roads in wagons and actually move into his own home. and you sat at your grandmother's knee, watched her learning to read cards and tell fortunes. You've written over 50 books.
Right,
over 60 now, and you've been in major magazines and newspapers, Cosmopolitan Magazine, New York Times, L.A. Times, and you've done all kinds of shows. Inasmuch as you were a part of the Buckland Gypsies, how many other, would they be called tribes?
Tribes, absolutely.
The Gypsy culture?
Right,
there?
Yes. The tribe is basically an extended family. So my family, of course, is the Buckland family, and they were centered in the southwest of England. Now, at some point, I guess, in the early 16th century, the gypsies moved into that area, and they got the name, they adopted the name of the area where they were. If you look at the southwest of England at maps, you'll see lots of little towns called Buckland in the Wold and Greater Buckland and Lesser Buckland. Sir Francis Drake's home was Buckland Abbey. So Buckland is actually is an old name from Roman times. In that part of the country, they used to produce goats and sell them as meat to the Romans. And the old word for goat was boca. So this was boca land, goat land, boca land. And from boca land, we get Buckland. So that part of the country, there are many little places called Buckland. And the gypsies, when they moved into England, those who gathered there adopted that as their name. And now there were other tribes in different areas, other families, if you like, in different areas who had their own names, took other names. My grandfather was at his time was the patriarch of the family. And he was what people would refer to as a gypsy king. Mm-hmm. Now, the gypsies themselves don't use the word king. The word is kralis, K-R-A-L-I-S. So he was the Romany kralis, or in other terms, the gypsy king. So he was the patriarch of the Buckland family. So it was just a whole extended family. Around about the turn of the last century, from the late 1800s into the 1900s, he, I guess, saw the writing on the wall so far as what was going to be happening with the gypsies. He could see that they would never have a homeland of their own, that they would need to keep moving, to keep traveling. And he decided that he would stop traveling the roads and he would settle in a regular house and try to become a regular person, like the non-gypsies or the gaujos, as we call them.
Mm-hmm.
So he settled in a regular house, and my father and my uncle, they were brought up as regular kids. They didn't live in the tents or the vados, the gypsy wagons. They just were brought up. They went to a regular school. So when I came along, my father, of course, my father, my uncle, my grandfather were all full-blood gypsies. My mother was not. My father married my mother, and she was not gypsy. So I'm a half-blood. I'm what was called a posh rat, a half-blood. So when I came along, I wasn't brought up in the gypsy ways. But around about early 1980s, I had written a number of books at that time. And Llewellyn, the publisher, wanted me to write a book on divination, various forms of divination. And I suddenly had an idea that it would be fun to base it on all the gypsy forms of divination. And so I went to my mother, my father was dead by that time, went to my mother to try to get from her as much information on the gypsies as possible. I remember a lot about my grandparents. I grew up during the Second World War. I was born in London, and I was born in 1934. And when war broke out in 1939, we moved up to Nottingham, a Robin Hood country, for the duration of the war. Then we moved back to London again. And while we were up in Nottingham, we would make trips down to London to visit my grandparents. And I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, and he would tell me these wonderful stories of gypsies and gypsy life and things that he did. And I remember my grandmother, I don't think I ever saw her without a deck of cards in her hand. And she used to read cards for everybody. Neighbors used to come knocking to just have their cards read. And she had a deck of cards. Now, in those days, this was the 1940s, for certainly the first half of the 20th century, it wasn't easy to get tarot cards. It was very difficult to find them.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Rom would do, what the gypsies would do, they would take a regular poker deck and use that as the minor arcana. And then they would cut cards the same size, 22 of them, and then draw their own pictures on to serve as the major arcana. And so they made up a full tarot deck. And I remember some of those wonderful pictures on my grandmother's cards. So moving back to the 1880s, when Llewellyn asked me to do a book on divination, I did this book looking at various types of divination used by gypsies. And when it came time for the big book event of the year in this country, what's now called the Book Expo America, but at that time was American Book Association Expo. And at that thing, Llewellyn would have a booth, and they would try to attract everybody there to see their latest publications. And in order to attract people, they would have different authors be there who mm-hmm. would do readings. And they asked me if I would do some tarot readings. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun if I could reconstruct my grandmother's tarot deck and do readings with that? So I put my mind to it, and I could remember a lot of the cards that she had, a lot of the specially drawn cards. The ones that I couldn't remember, I went back through old copies of the Strand magazine of like 1894, 1896, and so on, which I have, and found illustrations which would be typical, which would be pertinent to the cards. And I came up with a deck of cards using a poker deck for the minor tarot. The minor arcana, and I came up with a full deck and went to the ABA, and I read fortunes, told fortunes with that, and the CEO of Llewellyn, he and his wife were blown away with these cards, and they decided that they had to publish them, which they went on to do. But they were based on these cards which my grandmother used, and I always mm-hmm. remember being in her room and watching her using the cards, and even when there was nobody there having readings done, she would frequently be just going through the cards and studying them and looking at them. She was a character. I remember she always had a cigarette in her mouth, and she never shook the ash off it, so I used to watch fascinated as the ash grew longer and longer and longer until it finally fell off.
What wonderful stories that you are able to share because of the colorful persona. Now, in your book, you have so many sections in it, and I know we're only going to be able to touch upon a couple.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some fascinating points that you have throughout the book that relates to the gypsies when they were traveling. And mm-hmm. when you were talking about the traveling gypsies, I thought of the Bedouins that have been
right.
the nomadic people and of the Arab world, and how they're trying to force them to give it up. Now, so far, they haven't been able to do that. The Bedouins still are pretty independent.
Right.
But it is a natural patterning, I think, for nomadic people. I look at the Native Americans here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
One time, that's what they did. So it's those people that have that need, and of course, as you said, that they didn't have industry. They did not have farms. They had to go from place to place and to be able to do what they needed to do to survive. But your comments about nature that you have in the book, if dew lies thickly on the grass after a fair day, it's a sure sign of another fair day coming.
Right.
And you have these scattered through. If gnats fly thickly in the setting sun, expect warm weather. If they're seen a great deal in the spring, expect a warm fall. Now, the gypsies, obviously, had done a lot of observation with nature. Because
sure.
this is something they had to have seen more than once to be able to make the observation. Now, the fact that they had their own language that was related to the ancient Sanskrit, there is a misunderstanding, I think, on the part of a lot of people that the Gypsies were an illiterate people. They were not illiterate.
Right.
They were illiterate. Am I correct?
That is correct. They didn't do much in the way of writing. It was mainly oral. Consequently, in putting together, as in England today, the Gypsy Society, the Gypsy Society has been putting together a dictionary of Romanus, Romanus and English, English Romanus. And it's very, very difficult because many Gypsies, if you go to them and they use a word, say they're talking about Jalina Drom, which is traveling the road, different Gypsies might spell Jalin in different ways. So the Gypsy group is trying to standardize the spelling to put together this. Now the words, it's pretty much like somebody who hasn't used a language for a long time. In fact, it's very much like I mentioned to you earlier that I live in the heart of Amish country. Well, the Amish speak a sort of bastardized German, but if you listen to them, they throw in ordinary everyday words as well here and there, things where they haven't necessarily got a translation for it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the same sort of thing with the Gypsy language. If you listen to a couple of Gypsies talking, you'll hear odd English words coming out in the middle of the Romanus, because there is no direct translation for it. I used to have about 200 words, I guess, of Romanus, not much more. And these days, most Rom, they probably only have a couple of hundred at most words. Otherwise, they speak English. And one of the reasons for this is that, it used to be that as the Gypsies, looking at England now, as the Gypsies traveled around England, as they did for the whole of the year, wherever they were, if they wanted to send their children to school, the kids would go to the local school and they would stay there for as long as the family was in that particular area. Then they would leave the school and they would move on with the family to the next town and they would go to the school there. Well, right after the Second World War, the government, the British government, made it a law that any child had to remain in any one school for at least a year. So this really stopped the Gypsies from traveling around because the kids had to stay in school.
Mm-hmm.
So this certainly interfered with the movement of the Gypsies. It really put a negative spin on their whole lifestyle. And there were things like being brought up in the schools, then there was scant attention paid to the Romanus language, so much of it basically got lost, much as with the Native Americans. Many areas Native Americans were forbidden to use their own language. They had to go to the Christian schools and had to always speak English.
Yes, there's a lot of sadness with the history of the Gypsies, as there is with so many different ethnic groups throughout history. Because they were different, and in many instances they were feared because people didn't know them, they were very different than often what we don't understand we try to destroy.
Absolutely.
So the history that you have in the book is phenomenal, but I was not aware that as many as 600,000 Gypsies were murdered under the Germans.
Right, yes, yeah. In France
that
alone,
in
France alone, there were something like, I forget what it was, 21 concentration camps specifically for Gypsies. Yes.
Hideous.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, history is something, and that's one of the things that I love about your book, because you've got so much information. Now, I do know that many of my audience are going to say, okay, Donna, come on. You told me that you were going to talk a little bit about spells and a little bit of love magic here. So this is something. I just think that this is so cool. There's so many fun items that you have. You talk about jumping over the broom, you know, about a marriage ceremony. And I think there must have been some gypsies that came to the United States, because in the Appalachians, I believe, they did the very same ceremony.
Well, yeah, it is interesting because it ties in with what we were just talking about with the persecution of the gypsies. Now, in the 1400s, around that time, gypsies coming into France, there were so many of them that the authorities decided that they needed to get rid of them. So from France, they shipped them over to Louisiana.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
From Spain, they shipped them over to Brazil. From England, they shipped them down to Australia. So actually what this did was simply to spread the gypsies around the world, help spread them around the world. So, yeah, you certainly will find gypsies in this country. You'll find gypsies in just about every country today, because they were moved on. They were always being moved on.
Now, I didn't realize that the tingling in the ear, and this is cute, if your right ear tingles or itches, someone is speaking well of you. If your left ear tingles, they're speaking ill of you. And to find out who it is, call out loud the names of all those you can think it could be. The tingling will stop when you call out the correct name.
Right.
Boy, and if you've got a lot of friends, you're in trouble.
Absolutely. But the right and left, you'll find pretty much universally, not just with the gypsies, but in magic generally. If to the right is positive, to the left is negative.
Amazing. But there is so much fun information in here. And dress. I mean, let's talk about wedding ceremonies. Every tribe had particular traditions, and there were exchanges of bread and or salt.
Mm-hmm.
There were flowers that were exchanged, and then gold earrings. And, of course, Hollywood really took this to the max. I mean,
right, yes.
Was the movie Marlene Dietrich? I happened to see it a few years ago. It's a very old movie with Tyrone Power.
It's a wonderful movie.
Oh,
yes.
It's fabulous.
It is.
Awesome.
Yes, it's wonderful. But with the earrings, now traditionally, a boy child, for example, when born as a young child, the boy is given two earrings, a gold earring in each ear. When he grows up, when he finds the woman of his life, he will give her the earring from his right ear. So you can always tell, looking at a gypsy, whether he's married or single by whether he has one or two earrings.
Ah. Do they still do that?
Yeah, I have an earring, yes.
Oh,
yes.
For heaven's sake. Well, I just wondered, because we've got so many that wear earrings anymore, and they're in both ears, and you never know.
Right, yes, yeah. But certainly so far as the rum are concerned, then it's just the small gold earring.
Well, I know we're just about out of time here, but there's so many wonderful parts to this book. It's an absolute joy to read, and it gives you insights into a cultural tradition, getting away from the Hollywood stuff and from a lot of myth, but there is a lot of substance here, and there's information on healing, which I found very interesting. Because these are people that had to live off the land.
Right.
They're not unlike many people who are close to the earth. This is what they did, and today, obviously, they're not able to do it. Now, Raymond, I know we're out of time here, but what is your website that people can go to? By the way, I love the photo in this book. You're all in costume. You got the gypsy wagon behind you.
Thank you.
You know, it's just really, really super. But, Raymond, what is your website?
The website is www.raybuckland.com, all one word, of course, R-A-Y-B-U-C-K-L-A-N-D.
And now, if you want to learn about tea leaves, excuse me for interrupting.
Surely.
Tea leaves, anything like that, it's in the book. You can get the book, and you'll have fun with this. In fact, I would say if you want to get together with some friends and say, okay, let's check this out. Let's try this. Let's try that. Go to page such and such and so. He's got information on dice, on dominoes, on all kinds of things that I think you would just absolutely enjoy. Raymond Buckland, I think you've done an awesome job. And with over 50 books, you said it's over 60 now, have been one busy writer. And I'm so delighted I had the opportunity to have you on the show. His book is called Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic, Traveler's Stories, Spells, and Healings. It is a wonderful book. I recommend it highly. If you like history, if you are curious about anything, and you wonder about the gypsies, you've heard about all kinds of stuff, well, get it from someone who really is the gypsy and shares their family legacy with you. Again, Donna Sebo here, the Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic, a must read as far as I'm concerned. Again, Raymond Buckland, thank you so much for being my guest. Go to his website, raybuckland.com. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, TTAP.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, it's Donna. Telephone lines are now open, and if you would like to chat with me, I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. The telephone number to call in to is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And for those of you that have had stories about the paranormal, oh, excuse me, I should have finished. If you've never called in and talked with me before, when you call in, I'll ask you for your first name or your initial and what area of the country or the world you're calling in from. And then after that, I'll give you my mental impressions. When I'm finished, you can ask me a question about anything you like. Now, I do want to remind you that if you have a special story about the paranormal, I am collecting 100 stories for a book that I am wanting to have published, and I would love to hear your special personal paranormal experience, whether it's ghosts, animals, whatever it may be, near-death experiences, I'd love to hear your story. Why? Because I think the more we can share about our experiences, the better off we are. I've heard so many stories throughout the years, and regrettably, I didn't write a lot of them down, but I would love to hear about your particular experience. Maybe you have had an experience that will benefit somebody else and enable them to realize that the paranormal really isn't that far out. It is very much common everyday experience, but it's when we can talk about it, we take the fear out of it, and that makes a big difference. I know that made a big difference with me many years ago when I started in to developing my own intuitive skills, and I never ever would have known, it wouldn't have even crossed my mind. I came from a very, what I want to say, a very narrow environment when it came to anything to do with intuitive perspectives. And so when I met a woman who became my mentor, and she recognized my talents, that opened up the door. Well, I found there were a lot of things maybe she couldn't even explain to me, but through reading, I was able to find out about a lot of things. In fact, when I had an out-of-body experience, and I was twisting and turning in my body, I could see through my eyelids. I mean, I was going through all of this, and I thought, what's wrong with me? There's got to be something wrong with me. There was nothing wrong with me. I was merely out of the body, and I hadn't settled back in. And so all of this experience was happening, and it wasn't until I read a book by a man who was a Tibetan Lama, and his name was Tuzdi Lobsang Rampa. Maybe some of you are aware of him. He's been gone for a number of years now. But he wrote about 17, 18 books, and there was a day when I happened to pick up one of his books, and right there in the book, he went through an explanation of certain things, and I said, this is what's been happening to me. So that's why I want to put this book together, and I'd love to have your story. So send it to me, Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I, International.com, and I just am looking forward to it. We've been getting some wonderful stories, and it's going to be a lot of fun putting this book together. So if you'd like to be in it, send it along. And also give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. Now, next week coming up, we've got a great lineup of people. Now, I need to let you know, John St. Augustine, that was supposed to have been on the air with me this past Monday, he was in an area where he couldn't even get cell phone reception, and so he missed our time on the air, but he's going to be back with us next week. But before he comes on, we're going to be talking with Karen H. Sherman. We're going to be talking about mindfulness and the art of choice. Now, this is very important because so frequently we buy into the belief system that we don't have choice. And this, I think, is going to be fascinating to discuss. And then John's Every Moment Matters, great guy. He has worked with the Oprah Winfrey team for a long time. He's just got such wonderful stories to share. Then we're going to be talking with a gentleman by the name of Ira, and he's going to be with me on Wednesday. We're going to be talking Thai. Now, Thailand, as you know, is going through tremendous turmoil. I mean, they have the red shirts, and there's just all of this fighting that's going on. I just got an email from a client friend, and he's over in Thailand, and he said he's going to have to leave because of all the upheaval. Well, we're going to be talking about that wonderful country and that culture. Then also a cup of cappuccino for the entrepreneur's soul. That's going to be on Thursday. This is an awesome publication, and Cindy Thompson has a collection of stories from different people who have made it big time in many different ways in business. And if you're a business soul, I think you'll enjoy this tremendously. And then next Friday, we're going to be talking with Gary Reiswig. This is a man that has written about his family. The book is titled The Thousand Mile Stair, but it is absolutely a phenomenal publication because he talks about the history of Alzheimer's in his family and research that has been found out about this. It is an amazing book. So Gary is going to be on with us next Friday. So we have a eclectic group of people on next week. And programming, obviously, is going to be very different, as it always is on the Donna Sebo Show. And I invite you to tell your friends and do listen. And remember, always, you can listen into the archives, if you so desire, right here on bbsradio.com. If you miss any of the shows, just know that they're available for your listening pleasure. Just go in and check out how you are able to tune in after the fact, if that's the case. Oh, hey, get yourself a pad of paper and a pen together, because I have a recipe for Dr. Pepper ribs. I don't know about you, but in the Sebo household, we enjoy pork ribs a great deal. And I guess it's just because of Southern background, I'm not sure, but oh, they are so good, and quite frequently we will have them, and I'll just fix them just salt and pepper. But this is one that I decided I'd share. My husband loves Dr. Pepper. That's been his favorite soft drink ever since he was a kid. And he doesn't have it very often, but boy, he sure does enjoy it when he does have it. And so I thought this recipe would be fun for me to share it with you. So we'll be talking about that. Okay, and then give me a buzz if you want to chat, 888-815-9756. I wanted to share with you some information from a gentleman by the name of David Kelly. Now, he's the founder of IDEO Design Firm and also the Design School Stanford. Now, he has a kindergarten through 12th grade lab, and he has a feeling that education is going to be changing quite dramatically, and I feel that that probably is going to be the case, because with technology, so much of what has been considered the standard way of doing things is really quite out of date. The kids are often, not very often, but often they are ahead of the teachers relative to certain levels of technology. So teachers are really being challenged today because of the way that kids are learning. It's a whole different shift. And this is what he said. He said, in the classroom of the future, education will be custom-made for each student. Wouldn't that be a unique application? Every child will have a laptop program for his or her learning style and speed. And homeschooling may also continue to increase for this very reason. You can tailor the teaching to the child. At the same time, since we don't want computers to do all the teaching, we'll see more hands-on projects and group work, and more students will go out into the community to learn from business owners, and you'll see more retirees in the schools as mentors. And I really think that last statement is a very, very important one. People are living so much longer today, and I know there was a university, Old Dominion University, that the president of the university decided that he was going to do something that was a little bit different. This had to have been about, 15 years ago. And he brought in the opportunity for people after they retired from the military that any adult that wanted to come to college did not have to go through the same kind of processing that, let's say, a youngster just getting out of high school did. And depending on their work background, et cetera, they would give them the opportunity to advance their education, obviously. But more than that, they wanted them to come and be the teachers at the college because they found that the people that had retired from different environments, that whether it had been private enterprise or was the military, they had learned disciplines and had experiences that the young students didn't have, and that they were actually very, very good teachers. And so they would obviously put them through some kind of evaluation. But they found the results were just outstanding. And when we can take people who are really knowledgeable, experienced, and can bring them into an environment where they can be working with the younger generation, what a blessing all the way around. Because you need the wisdom of the older individual and the experience of the older individual along with the energy and enthusiasm and brightness of the youth. Not that the older people don't have brightness, but it's a whole different genre. And you want to encourage curiosity, ingenuity with the young, but you also want to have them become aware that discipline is something that's very important and forming good habits that enable them to be successful and be productive parts of society is also very important. But I can remember when I was in high school, there was a teacher that I had who was a former Marine, and he had served time in, Vietnam, and it just had all kinds of experience. And I'll never forget him sitting in this classroom. There was a podium, and he had a habit of leaning his elbows on the podium and just sort of sticking his chin in his hand and looking out of the classroom, and he was teaching history to us. And he would get sort of bored with us, and then when we found out that he had been a former Marine, we'd start asking him. We'd say, well, we'll do our homework, we'll promise it, but you tell us about X, Y, Z. And so we got to find out about him, and he would tell us real experiences and stories of his own life. And I'm telling you, history came alive. It was marvelous. It really was great, and we gained perspectives from his own personal experience. And I'm sure he was discriminating in what he shared with us because he had seen a lot of violence and a lot of ugliness. But he made you think. And it really added a richness to the subject matter because he had walked the line of experience and was willing to share it with us. And that is one of the treasure memories that I have of school, of a teacher that gave more than just what was in the book, but gave a part of himself as well. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break for a moment. Hey, that phone line is open. If you want to give me a call, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-815-9756. And then we'll talk about the ribs. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. I've got a poem here by Lila Paris, and it's about butterflies. And, oh, we're seeing so many of them here in the Pacific Northwest. It's just a joy to see them. Summer's almost here. Well, it feels like summer today. We're in the 70s here in the Pacific Northwest. A butterfly, morning apple blossoms weighing down the trees in fragrant petals as happy honeybees buzz here and there. Ah, it just feels so good. Really love the warm temperatures after a cold, cold season. Okay, if you've got that pad of paper and pen, here's the recipe for Dr. Pepper ribs. Now, ribs, again, in our household, we like them plain with just salt and pepper. And it's really quite simple to fix them. And if you're a person that likes to grill, then this is going to be right up your alley. But if you're someone, sometimes like me, you're not able to fire up a grill, so what you do is that you fix them in the oven. So I'm going to give you the information on both ways of fixing it. If you're going to use a grill, you want to prepare it for indirect heat cooking because you don't want, you know, real, real, real hot coals. You want to be able to have those coals so they can keep their heat for some hours because you want these to cook slowly. Now, what you do, here are the ingredients. Let's start with those first. You're going to need 3 tablespoons of light brown sugar, 3 tablespoons of light brown sugar, a half a teaspoon of salt, 1 tablespoon of dry Southwest seasoning, 1 tablespoon of dry Southwest seasoning, 2 teaspoons of onion powder, about 4 pounds of slab pork spare ribs. You're going to need 2 cups, a 16-ounce can of Dr. Pepper, the soft drink, and 2/3 of a cup of ketchup. Now, all you need to do is mix your sugar. You got your grill going. You've got your sugar and your salt with 2 teaspoons of seasoning and 1 teaspoon of the onion powder. And you just rub it over the ribs. You just rub it in. And then you place the ribs meaty side down on the grill over indirect heat. And you just cover the grill, let it cook for about 15 minutes, and then turn your ribs and cover. And then you let it just cook in there. You just leave them alone for 2 hours. Just let those ribs sit in there, and they just slow cook. Just nothing like, of course, with your charcoal, and if you want, you can add, you know, bits of mesquite wood or something like this if you want a different kind of a smoky flavor to it. Then, during the last 20 minutes of the cooking time, then you're going to baste them with your Dr. Pepper sauce. So this is how you make up the sauce. In a pot, you're going to put your Dr. Pepper, your ketchup, the remaining teaspoon of seasoning, and teaspoon of onion powder. You bring it to a boil over medium-high heat and cook it occasionally until it gets thick. That's how simple that is. And I like things a little spicy, so I might add a little bit of cayenne or something. That's just me. That's just my adaptation. But if you just follow the recipe, then you wouldn't be having any spice. This is sort of a sweet taste to it. And then you will just put that over the ribs in the last 20 minutes. Now, if you want to do this in the oven, it's very simple. All you have to do is preheat your oven to 325 degrees and take your large roasting pan that you're going to put the ribs in, line it with foil because it's really easy to clean up when you line it with foil. And then you put your ribs in, follow the same directions with the rub and all of that, and then you put the meaty side up on the pan and then cover it with foil, and you roast it in the oven for an hour and 45 minutes at 325 degrees. Then you uncover the ribs. They're going to be just real tender, and then you baste them and keep them in the same temperature of the oven. And by golly, they're just going to have a nice glaze on them, and they're absolutely delicious. So this is just such an easy, easy recipe, and it's so convenient if you are going to have, you know, a group of people. If you've got a nice double oven, you can even use two racks in there in one. If you've got a nice big oven, you put them on two racks if you wanted to and just bake them. And then you're going to have plenty of ribs for everybody. But it's so easy and so simple, and with a little bit of coleslaw, fresh coleslaw salad, and maybe some hot cornbread. Just real, real good eating. One of my most memorable barbecues that I was ever able to attend was with a very good friend of mine, African American, and I'd known her for a long time, and she invited me over for a barbecue. And to my amazement, we went out into the backyard, and her husband had taken a huge oil drum, a drum that transported something in it. I don't think it was oil, but anyway, it had been thoroughly cleaned, and he had cut it so that he could take that oil drum and have the lid. He put hinges on the lid, and that man could fix a whole pig or a side of beef inside of this, and he designed the racks on the inside and fixed it so the coals could be put in there, and it could just cook a barbecue for days. Actually, it was just absolutely amazing what he had done with that big metal drum, and it was just fabulous food, just absolutely delicious. Whether it was beef, whether it was the pork or chicken, he always ended up making such wonderful barbecue. It seems like the guys have a knack for this. Maybe it goes back to the caveman days. What do you think? Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Now, if you're out working in the garden and you are really concerned about ants, and I know that when I lived in California, that was something we always had to be very attentive to, because ants just were everywhere, and before you know it, you'd have them in your house. So you had to be very thoughtful, make sure if there were sugary things of any kind that you made sure that you didn't drip it along whatever, because the ants always had their scouts out, and they'd find out where your food was, and the next thing you knew, they had come into the house. So there was often a challenge in dealing with ants when I was in California, and we just had to be aware. Well, in today's world, instead of using poisons like were used so long ago, we now are working with as much natural as we possibly can, because we've come to realize that when we poison our environment, we're going to poison ourselves. Ants are fascinating creatures, and they are creatures that you need to be aware of. They serve a very valuable purpose, but if you really want to take care of things, you have to know how to work with them so that you don't get angry with them, but you know how to make them sort of part of your environment in a friendly way. And I'm looking at the clock, and I'm realizing I'm going to have to talk about ants some other time and how you can use natural pesticides to keep them in control. This is Donna Sebo. It's absolutely glorious here in the Pacific Northwest, and I hope wherever you are, you're enjoying just as much beautiful weather and are going to have a fabulous weekend with friends and family. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a fabulous weekend. We'll see you right back here on BBS Radio, same time, same place, right here on Station 1, The Donna Sebo Show, on Monday. Take care. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.